We're just talking about the space program, and there are many people out there still who believe that we faked all of the lunar landings. I bring your attention to the next George Norrie show coming up on Coast to Coast AM. So George will actually be addressing that with the anniversary of the lunar landing 40 years later, and with a space historian that might be the kind of guy who could probably give you some better answers to those well-intended questions, I'm certain. Coming up on Coast to Coast next week. Also, if you're going to Comic-Con in San Diego, say hi to my friend David Mack, who's going to be there signing autographs and stuff. If you haven't been to a good Comic-Con lately, it's always a trip. If nothing else, just to see how other people get all dressed up. And lately now, I don't know if you've caught wind of it, but there's all this tension at Comic-Cons between all of the Twilight fans, all of the new vampire fans, and fans of sort of more traditional comic book fare. At least that's what I've been reading. Don't know whether that's true, but in any event, if it's going to get played out anywhere, it will at the San Diego Comic-Con. You'll find it more if you go online for that. So what's the truth to all of these studies that have come out? All right, the one that says reduced calorie diet of any kind, just reduce your calories by two-thirds and you'll live longer. Or what about the study from Japan, which echoed other studies that said chubby people live longer? Better to be slightly chubby than slightly skinny. It'll add years onto your life. And what foods are opiates, or at least essentially act like that for your body, where you simply can't give up these addictions? You want to, but you can't. It's like what foods are like crack. We'll talk about it next with Dr. Neil Barnard. On Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Dr. Neil Barnard is the president of the Physicians Committee for Responsible Medicine, the PCRM. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. Good evening, Dr. Neil. How are you?
I am just fine. Great to be with you this evening.
Let's start with that news story from last week, the Japanese study that says slightly chubby people will live longer than slightly skinny people. Better to be slightly chubby than at a perfect weight or just below it. Where are you with that?
Well, I think you summed it up perfectly in the introduction, which is that there are studies all over the map. And the one that you described, when it came out, some people would think, gee, maybe it's good to be fat, and I shouldn't try to slim down. I have to say that's swimming against the tide. There have been quite a number of studies that have compared body weight and longevity. And it looks like if you're a little bit on the slim side, you're going to have an advantage.
Well, okay, well, yeah, there are studies all over the map. That's true, but in particular, actually, I thought what was interesting about that is they said in this Japanese study that it wasn't so much new, the idea that somehow skinny people don't live as long, but rather what was new was that slightly chubby people lived longer. That there was like normal or at like the ideal weight, but that they actually, if you have a few more pounds on, you actually do better. Not fat, because obese would be different than slightly chubby. So that was their point, was you can't be fat, but you could be slightly chubby and you'll do better.
Right, and that's exactly what I'm suggesting, is that although the study did indeed show that, when you look at the body of studies that have looked at that very question, generally speaking, if you're a little on the slim side, you're going to do better.
Okay. Now, what about this story that's been getting a lot of play lately about just a reduced calorie diet? I put up a link on my blog at coasttocoastam.com to the BBC version of the story, but ABC News did a version of it too, in which they showed that just reducing calories, reducing your fat intake just to a third of what people might normally take in. It could be meat, it could be anything, but just by taking it down to a third of what people ordinarily eat, that will add years to your life.
Yeah, it's taken down by about a third. True. People have been speculating about this for a long period of time. It does seem to be the case. People do seem to live longer, and you also have lower risk of a number of conditions. Certain cancers are less common, for example. The issue, though, is how you get there and how can you stay there? Because if you're doing it, if I can use this word, just doing it intentionally, saying every day I'm just going to be a little bit hungry. Cutting out a third of your calories is a lot. That's challenging to do. So
I think it's actually, to be totally honest, I think it's actually you have to cut out two-thirds of your calories. You live on a third of the calorie intake that a normal person would.
Okay. Yeah, either way.
Even harder.
It's very difficult. If you imagine that, let's say you get up in the morning and you eat maybe 1,800 or 2,000 calories in the course of the day, if you're cutting out a big chunk of that, you're going to be very hungry day after day, and that gets old by Wednesday. So the question then is not is it a good idea, but because I think it is a good idea to reduce our calories overall, but the question is how do we get there? And the best way to do it seems to be to choose foods that are naturally low in calories and naturally filling, as opposed to if what you're eating is your normal high-calorie foods that most people have already been eating, meat, cheese, fried foods, and so forth, and then you try to cut back on that, the portion sizes end up being so small that it's a very punishing way to go. If, on the other hand, what we've seen in our research studies is when you switch people to eating lots of vegetables and fruits and whole grains and beans, those foods are naturally low in calories, but because they are so high in fiber, they tend to be filling. So you're accomplishing much of the same thing. You're reducing the calorie intake, but a person doesn't really know it because they're filling up on high-fiber foods.
Now, I know just some of what you are about. I have your books about breaking the food seduction, which we'll get to coming up, and Dr. Neil Barnard's program for reversing diabetes. Let me just put all our cards up on the table. Do you only advocate a vegan lifestyle? I mean, is that the bottom line for you?
Well, if you look at the body of research, that is clearly the healthiest. That's really the starting point of when you start seeing just dramatic health benefits. Having said that, I think most people have not grown up with that kind of thing. And so every step that a person makes toward that kind of diet is a good thing. I grew up in Fargo, North Dakota, and my grandfather was a cattle rancher. And I didn't know anything about this kind of this way of eating when I grew up. But I'm happy to say I have made a lot of changes in my own diet, and I now don't eat animal products at all, keep oils very low. And for people who are new to this, I do have some steps or tricks, if you want to put it that way, to help them to get closer to a really optimal diet. And it's easy to do. Anybody can do it, and the benefits are enormous.
As a scientist, I have to ask you, if research came out tomorrow that said vegan is one way to go, but the word optimal may be too precious, that it's a good way, you can live a good, healthy vegan lifestyle, but that there are other ways to live a healthy lifestyle that aren't vegan. As a scientist, would you be open to that kind of research too?
Well, I think you have to be open to any new facts that come out. Having said that, the data supporting the value of a vegan diet is enormous, and the value attesting to its acceptability among people who jump into research studies, it seems to be, surprisingly enough, not only the most effective diet. By effective, I mean for weight control, getting your cholesterol down. There just isn't any that's anything in its league. But surprisingly enough, it's also the most acceptable diet that we have seen. If I say to you, cut calories, as I was saying earlier, that gets old very fast. If I say, go low carb, after a while, you'd eat the sofa, because you're looking for, you like pasta, you can never have another cookie if you're following that kind of low-carb approach. But when people go on a vegan diet, they learn some new ways of thinking about food, but then they are never counting calories, never saying no to carbohydrate. And it's the most effective and the most acceptable therapeutic diet I've ever seen.
I understand that. But you would be open if some other program came along that said, that's good, but this is also good.
I think it's essential to be open to new facts. That's why we do research here at the Washington Center for Clinical Research. We do a lot of work looking at ways to refine diets. So, sure.
You know, the reason I bring that up is actually it even came up in open lines earlier, is I heard just for years, oh, you got to go soy, got to go soy, got to go soy. And then, you know what, soy turns out not to be so good for you. And there was a lot of people that had a lot of research that said a soy-based protein diet, that's all you need. You can get by on that just fine. And now you got people saying, absolutely not soy. Don't, no soy. Where are you on that?
I don't buy that. There have been a number of people, and there are some really rather paranoid sounding websites saying that if you have soy, it's a terrible thing. When you look at the data on it, as you were suggesting earlier, look at the studies. The only really strong connection that I have seen between soy and health is related to cancer risk. And it goes like this. If a woman consumes about a cup of soy milk per day or one serving of tofu per day, if she consumes it in childhood, her risk of breast cancer is about 30% lower compared to women who don't consume soy. And that has been shown again and again. It's quite convincing data. So I know there are people who suggest all kinds of issues with regard to soy. They have not panned out, that the negatives have not panned out. Having said that, the kind of diet that I promote, a diet that avoids animal products, it's not the soy cheerleading societies. Soy is one way to go, and it's a very handy thing for replacing cheese and burgers and ice cream and everything. They've made soy products very delicious. So if a person doesn't want to have it, they don't have to have it. But I don't think the health risks have panned out at all.
Well, okay, but what about the idea of soy is produces estrogen in men? That's pretty much a given, isn't it?
Well, that I think you've put your finger on exactly the issue that gets right. a lot of play. So I'm glad that you raised it. Soy contains compounds that are referred to as phytoestrogens, phyto, P-H-Y-T-O.
Right.
Phyto means plant, and they're plant estrogens, phytoestrogens. What they do is they attach to the same receptors in your body that estrogens would attach to, and yet they are extremely weak. And what they do is they seem to somehow block a woman's natural estrogenic activity, and so it reduces her estrogen a little bit. It's sort of like if you could imagine a plane arriving at an airport, and it arrives at the little jetway. If it's a tiny little private plane and it's occupying that whole jetway, well, no other big planes can get in there. The big planes are the estrogen. The little planes are the plant estrogens that are soaking up all the attachment spots, so it stops the natural estrogenic activity that a woman would have. So that's thought to be related to the reduced risk of cancer. Now, to tell you the truth, nobody knows the real reason why there's less cancer in soy consumers. So people have said, well, what about men? Would that little bit of estrogenic activity affect men? The answer seems to be no. There have been a number of studies out on this just recently, I think there was one last month, showing it does not affect a man's testosterone. He will still be a man. It doesn't affect, it's not feminizing in any way. And if anything, if you're having that soy burger or soy bacon or soy sausage instead of the meat version, you're much less likely to develop impotence to develop the other risks that come from a high cholesterol and perhaps even an overly high testosterone level.
Well, I can see that, but I actually I go sort of following that story pretty closely because I work out a lot and I made a point to jump from soy proteins to whey proteins and I've sort of followed it because I think I felt like I'd been lied to a lot about soy. And we even had a guest on Coast to Coast who did a whole book on the fact that the science behind soy was kind of, you know, intentionally misrepresented by the soy industry, that they actually had test results that said it's really not that good for you, but they went ahead with the whole, you know, massive campaign anyway. And I thought he was a really good guest, and I thought he made his point. He had pretty well researched, but I think in that research they did in fact prove that some of the effects on men from soy is weight gain, lower sperm count, and perhaps an increase in erectile dysfunction. That was not that long ago that I thought they had pretty good science on that. But you're saying that somehow recently there's new science that said that may not be true.
Yeah, you know, you really do have to look at the quality of these studies. And in some cases, they'll say, well, in the test tube, you'll find that a soy molecule attaches to another molecule or attaches to a receptor, and so therefore there could be a problem or something like that. When you look at men and you stick a needle in their arm, in their arms, and you measure their testosterone level, it's not reduced to any significant degree by soy. And when you look at groups of boys or men who are soy consumers, they live longer, they're healthier, they're trimmer. There isn't any problem with fertility at all. By the way, look at Japan. In Japan, historically, they've been consuming soy for generations.
Right.
They have not had a fertility problem. They haven't had a longevity problem. They don't have a feminization problem. They live longer and are healthier than we are until McDonald's, Burger King, the other fast food chains, and a meat-based diet started to become popular in the 1980s. Now they are chubby. Now their longevity is starting to actually decline. So I have to say, you know, and don't get me wrong, my whole family, when I was a kid, my extended family was in the cattle business. That was our product. But I have to say that a meat-based diet is a mistake from the standpoint of health, not to mention the environmental issues and all the other things that come up with it, that getting away from that is an important step. And if a person wants to go to soy, fair enough. But there are other ways to think about it. Let's say soy is an Asian product. You might say, well, I want to follow a more Mediterranean approach. So pasta, vegetables, that kind of thing, or a Latin American approach, beans, rice, corn tortillas, and so forth. There are many ways to get on a healthy diet. Soy is just one of the bridges to it. If a person doesn't want it, you don't have to have it.
Now, again, funny you should bring up Japan. It's in Japan that they do the study that says if you're not obese but you're slightly chubbier, you'll live longer. And they studied Japanese people in doing it.
Right. Yeah,
I mean, and it was all done in Japan, so there was a long-term study of middle-aged and elderly people.
Right. Yeah. No. I'm not disputing the study. I'm not saying it's a bad study. It was 50,000 people. It's Tohoku University.
That's huge. Isn't that gigantic by study standards? 50,000 people.
Yeah, it's a good study. I don't want to diss it at all. Their point was that if I remember correctly, their point was if you're slightly on the heavy side compared to being very skinny. Then it's a good thing. Now, why would a person be skinny? You can be skinny. Skinny is two things. A thin person can get there because they're health conscious, they're watching what they eat, they're exercising, and they're trim. That person's going to live a long life, and they're going to live a good life. On the other hand, you can be very thin because you have a health problem, a problem that prevents you from eating foods. Maybe you have advanced cancer. Maybe you have a respiratory problem that came from years of smoking. And so your body is not able to maintain weight. If you lump all those people together, it's a very mixed group. So
They factored for that. It's in the study that they took out. They factored for sick. They factored for smokers. They factored for everything. And they took that all out of the study. I'm just saying what the study said. That they was really just thin people versus chubby people, and the chubby people won. So I'll grant you that it would seem like they would be more inclined to include sick people in the study, but they were able to balance that out. Well, anyway, it's interesting. But if you don't want to, if you find yourself addicted to foods and you are eating more than you want to eat, like chocolates, cheese, as you mentioned before, meats, Your book about the food seduction says that our bodies become acclimated to certain foods as drugs, and that we get addicted to them in the same way. We think of it as a mental addiction, but it actually is a physical addiction that we can't break.
Yes, and not surprisingly so. I mean, the brain has structures that allow us to experience pleasure, and they're not there just for us to feel good. They're there to keep us doing things. So let's say you happen upon a food that is particularly a good source of calories or something like that. Back when life was not what it is today, millions upon millions of years ago, that was a useful brain structure to have. You would get a little bit of an opiate effect from certain kinds of foods. A little bit of dopamine follows from one neuron to another. That sets down a memory trace that says, remember that food source and eat it again, and that'll help stave off starvation. Well, certain modern foods, sugar, for example, and so forth, they trigger those same brain areas, and they cause you to come back to the vending machine again and again and again.
Hmm. All right, so let's leave that there. We'll come back. We'll find out what these foods are. The foods that your body most commonly associates as a drug fix that needs to be met. And then we'll talk about the difference between a mental addiction versus the physical addiction, how you break that, and then Dr. Neil Barnard will address reversing diabetes. That's one of his books, and it'll help people without going on drugs, how you can reverse diabetes. Diabetes is out of control. I was just talking to somebody today who has the sugars, as we used to call it, and he's right now just trying to adjust to a life of insulin and other stuff, but he could give it all up tomorrow. If you follow Dr. Neil Barnard's advice next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. What ails you? Could it be the food you're eating and you're not getting the straight dope from your doctor? Well, you'll hear it from Dr. Neil Barnard next. What are the foods that are addicting you? Whether you know it or not, whether you want it or not, it's just like a drug. Next on Coast to Coast AM, this is Ian Punnett. Well, and I spent about a year, Dr. Barnard, as a vegetarian, and I kind of bordered on vegan for a brief period of time, but I found myself actually craving protein from milk and cheese, and I use that pretty regularly. But now I'm beginning to wonder whether it's just a matter of, you know, I craved the protein, or you're saying I craved the drug of cheese. The cheese was my drug of choice.
Well, you know, I have to say it's an interesting thing. Where we started wandering into this area was I was doing some research studies here in Washington, D.C. We used vegan diets for weight control because they are terrific for it. And if you think about it, if you're not eating any of the chicken fat that a chicken has been using to store calories, and if you're not eating any of the cow fat or pig fat that those animals have been using to store calories, well, the calories you're taking in is going to be reduced. We also discovered that when people start a vegan diet, their body actually burns calories just slightly faster. This occurs after meals for about maybe 3 hours or so after the meal. There's something called the thermic effect of food, which means your body is giving away some of the calories as body heat rather than storing them as fat. So that's a good thing. And so people lost weight. Their cholesterol levels come way down. And as you mentioned earlier, we've done a lot of work on diabetes showing that a very low-fat vegan diet, for some people, their diabetes improves so much you would never know they even had it. So the benefits are there. But having said that, there were a couple of people in the study who took a trip to Greece. They came back. They said, Dr. Barnard, I know this is a vegan diet, but have you ever tasted feta cheese? And the way they described it, it sounded very much like an alcoholic just fondly remembering his last drink. I started thinking, well, could there be something about cheese that actually is a drug? So I looked into this subject. And the first thing I found was that sometimes milk products contain tiny traces of morphine. I'm talking about actual morphine. The amounts are extremely small, and it varies with time of year. But apparently it's made in the cow's liver, and it gets into body fluids, including milk. But I decided the amounts are too small to really account for this sort of craving that people have. Where I believe the issue really is with the casein protein itself. That's the primary protein in cow's milk product. That casein molecule breaks down into smaller molecules when you digest it, some of which are little protein fragments that we call casomorphins. They're casein-derived, morphine-like compounds. They attach to the same receptors in your brain that heroin attaches to. They're not as strong, but they're there. And they appear to cause a little bit of a calming effect, but we believe this is also the basis for the addictive effect that people have, especially with cheese. I don't know if you experience this, but people, they like milk, they like ice cream, but cheese is, for some reason, the one that they have the most trouble getting away from. Well, cheese also happens to be the most concentrated in the casein protein. And so if you swallow it, and if I were to measure the contents of your stomach, you'd find these casomorphins all right over the place after eating cheese.
Well, I think some of that has to do with, well, not just culturally. I mean, I live here in the upper Midwest, and cheese is a part of a lot of, you know, sort of traditional cultural, you know, dishes that are shared communally, important meals in our, you know, sort of life cycle. But I think that some of that, too, has to do with the fact that it helps you not be so hungry. And so that if you were giving up on meat, you know, if when I didn't eat meat for a long period of time, I would have pasta, and I then, but then I would have like, you know, tomato sauce with it, and I'd have to have, I had cheese. I mean, I wasn't having any, I mean, I could put veggies in it, but without the cheese, I was hungry right away.
You know, it's funny. People are eating more cheese than ever. If you look back 100 years ago, if you looked at 1909 compared to 2009, 100 years ago, your average American in a year's time ate less than 4 pounds of cheese in the whole course of a year. We just weren't using it. Nobody had yet figured out that you could sell cheese pizza to people with, automatic delivery to your house and so forth,
right,
as we have today.
Thank
well,
God.
It was less than 4 pounds a year. Today, it's more than 32 pounds per person per year.
Whoa.
Where are we putting that extra 28 Whoa. Pounds of cheese? Well, we are fattening ourselves up, especially kids. Around the 1970s, 1980s, fast foods became ubiquitous. Before that, they were spotty. Well, now every single sandwich at every single fast food place just about has cheese over the top, and it's nutritionally the equivalent of Vaseline. It's got, by that I mean, it's very high in fat, particularly saturated fat. That's the bad fat, the kind that's linked to heart attacks, the,
sure.
the kind that's linked to insulin resistance that ultimately can lead to diabetes. And when people get hooked on this, they tend to eat it. And just as you said, they think, well, it's got protein, it's got some calcium in it. It does have those things, but it has so many bad ingredients that we're better off just setting it aside completely.
Okay, but, you know, and let's just say again, I mean, you're a vegan, so you're going to think that everything that has that comes, you know, from an animal, whether it's milk or cheese, you're predisposed to thinking of it as bad anyway.
Philosophically. Well, that's a little bit like saying that a person who's done research on quitting smoking and they find that people live longer, that they're going to naturally then find fault with tobacco. Well, of course you are. In our research study, starting in 2003, the U.S. government, the National Institutes of Health, supported my team to test out a vegan diet for diabetes. And we've published 5 or 6 reports in peer-reviewed journals. And the people who come into the study with type 2 diabetes, obesity, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, when they get away from meat and they get away from dairy products, including cheese, they get away from these things. And so their breakfast might be a big bowl of oatmeal with cinnamon and raisins instead of the cheese omelet. Their lunch might be, instead of the meat taco, it's the bean burrito. Instead of the meat chili, it's the vegetable chili. And they can have their pasta, but if they top it with a marinara sauce instead of the meat sauce or the Alfredo sauce, the weight loss can be dramatic. There was a man in our study named Vance. Vance's father was dead by age 30. Vance was 31 when he was diagnosed with diabetes. He went on this diet. He lost 60 pounds in the course of a year. His blood sugar control, which was terrible at the outset, it improved so much that his doctor sat him down, stopped his diabetes, and if he walked into any clinic in America after that, no one would have even recognized he'd ever had diabetes. He had had erectile dysfunction with all that weight and an unhealthy diet, and he was in a new relationship, so that wasn't so handy for him. And the erectile dysfunction got better after about 5-6 months. Bottom line, things get dramatically better, and when you look at those data, it is impossible to make a case that the healthiest diet, the best diet for longevity, is not a vegan diet. That is clearly the way to go.
Okay. But it's possible to have an unhealthy vegan diet, too.
Oh, well, sure. In fact, I discovered this in one of my studies where, don't get me wrong, getting away from meat and dairy products is a good idea. It's always a good idea, and bringing them back into your diet is a bad idea. By that, I mean it increases health problems. But the manufacturers are so creative. I had a research participant come into our center, and she said, I discovered how you can have junk food on a vegan diet. She'd gone to the store and got this red licorice they refer to as Twizzlers.
Right.
And it happens to have no animal products, but it's basically sugary, starchy, artificially colored stuff. So you can eat an unhealthful diet. But what most people do is they eat a lot of sugary junk food and meat and cheese. They're physically inactive, and you put all that together, it's an unhealthy way to go. In fact, just real quickly, and I don't mean to belabor this point, over the last century, people have increased their meat consumption by about 50 pounds per person per year. That's mostly chicken. Americans now eat more than 1 million chickens per hour. Our increase in cheese consumption is almost 30 pounds per person per year. Our increase in sugar is 30 pounds per person per year just since the 60s. You put all that together, and a meaty diet and a sugary diet is what's causing the problems that we have in America today with regard to health.
Well, okay, but let's take Twizzlers off the table. I mean, when I say a vegan diet can be unhealthy, okay, obviously, if you're sitting around eating Baby Ruths, I mean, whatever. But I just mean you have there have been some reports that have come out that said that vegans are going to have a problem with what, lower bone density, right? That there was that omnivores or even vegetarians that eat egg or dairy products have the same bone density, but you start to run into a bone density problem if you're vegan. True?
Not problem, but one would expect the bone density to be a little bit lower, but one would not expect it to translate into any risk. And the reason for that is this. If you walked around your whole life carrying extra weight, that strains the muscles, which in turn strain the bones, and so your bone density tends to be better. Or not better, but you tend to have denser bones. Vegans tend to be thinner. They have. There was a large study called the EPIC study, European Prospective Investigation, investigational study. They tracked vegans, vegetarians, fish eaters, meat eaters. The vegans were clearly more likely than the other groups to be at a good, healthy weight. Their longevity is overall a little bit better. And if you're not carrying around a lot of extra weight, your bones are not going to have that extra thickness to them. But that's not going to translate into, so far as I'm aware, to an increased risk of fracture. Now, having said that, don't get me wrong. I think you're making a really good point, Ian, which is that with any kind of diet, including a vegan diet, you want to plan. So let's say a person is never getting any calcium in their diet. Well, it's hard to do, but let's say you're getting very little calcium. I think you should really be getting at least, say, 600 milligrams of calcium per day. So plan for it. That means green leafy vegetables. It means beans. Both of those are very calcium-rich foods. One exception, spinach. Spinach has got a lot of calcium, but it's a selfish vegetable. The calcium absorption from spinach is very low. But broccoli, Brussels sprouts, the other green leafy vegetables have a lot of calcium, and it's highly absorbable, the bean group too. So I think you're making a great point. You don't want to just say, I'm vegan, that's it. Potato chips and Dr. Pepper are it. Choose from four healthy food groups. Those are the vegetable group, the fruit group, the whole grain group, and the bean group. Every day, take a multiple vitamin, and that's good advice for anybody. And if you put that together, that's a really healthy way to go.
What's the most fun thing you eat?
The most fun thing?
Yeah. What's the most fun thing you eat?
Well, I guess everybody has their own view of fun.
Right. For me, what's yours?
I'm quite partial to spicy foods.
Okay.
And for me, that can take a couple of different forms. Even when I was a kid growing up, there was a Mexican restaurant down on Main Street in Fargo that I used to go to. And the number two burrito was filled with jalapeno peppers. And I have to say, maybe there's heroin in peppers that we'll find someday. I used to love it. It was filled with beans, peppers, and a nice gravy that happened to entirely be vegan. I didn't think of it that way, but it was a delicious food. Or Indian food. Or in Washington, we have a large Ethiopian culture. And in Ethiopia, people are traditionally vegan 2 days per week in one prominent religious community.
Right.
They make the most out-of-this-world food. When I was a kid, I never had sushi or miso soup or those kinds of things, but I have to say I'm very partial to Japanese food, and sushi can be, of course, the fishy sushi, which I would never touch. I don't think you should eat it unless you're very well insured, but the vegetable sushis are delicious.
So the idea of a raw fish, you don't accept the arguments about that being a very healthy diet.
Whether it's from the standpoint of the bad fats in fish that counteract the effect of the good fats, or if it's the question of the mercury in fish that is so much in the news these days, or the fact that they may be contaminated with cholera or something like that that gets into. I mean, I'm not blaming the fish. I mean, the problem is that fish are living in the human sewer.
Right.
They're living offshore and fish are carnivores. So unlike a cow or chicken, the little fish eats a little bit of mercury and the big fish eats that smaller fish, and the bigger fish eats that one. So you're bio-concentrating things. Plus, then you have the problems of, as I mentioned, the viruses that are cholera-inducing, and viruses and bacterial, other microbes that cause health problems. So no, I wouldn't go near fish.
So if one got rid of cheese, one got rid of meat, one got rid of fish, one got rid of, all dairy products, would diabetes almost disappear?
You could, I really wish that we could do exactly what you described and do it as early in life as possible. The person who's going to have the healthiest life is a person who is, number one, breastfed, not bottle fed, as an infant. For some reason, breastfeeding, which is absolutely natural and it's universal throughout the mammalian kingdom, it became unfashionable in the post-World War II period. So everybody's bottle feeding. So they're giving a human baby the milk of a cow, and that increases a number of health risks. It also seems to decrease IQ. It has all kinds of problems. So the kids should be fed in breast milk. And then after that, they should be raised on plant-based diets. As I was describing earlier, I think everybody ought to be taking basically a daily multiple vitamin. You put
I just going to go back to that. So, but the idea of getting rid of diabetes, if we got rid of cheese, if we got rid of meat, yes, if we got rid of fish, we got rid of dairy products, would diabetes just virtually disappear?
I think it would be, I don't know if it would be absolutely gone, but it would certainly be a lot less common than it is today, because in our research, when we use vegan diets for people with diabetes, their diabetes improves dramatically. By that, I mean their blood sugars come way down. Their need for medication for many people reduces. The risk of complications diminishes, and I'm talking about people in our research, the average person has had diabetes for 8 years already. If I can get to that person early on or before diagnosis, then yes, we could prevent this disease in the vast majority of cases.
What other diseases do you think we would eliminate if we were all vegans?
Well, I don't want to say we'd necessarily eliminate them, because a person can develop, say, heart disease from congenital defects and things like that. There could be other contributors, but the heart disease, which is the cause of death of half of Americans, would be dropped to just a fraction of what it is today. Kids today, when they're getting their high school diplomas, already have the beginnings of coronary artery disease that's going to lead to serious problems and shortening their life. If kids were raised on a plant-based diet, wouldn't happen so much or nearly so frequently. Most forms of cancer, the most common forms of cancer, like colon cancer or prostate cancer, would be less frequent as well. Obesity would be much less frequent. So if you're looking at the things that lead people into the doctor's office, they'd be less common. Hypertension as well. My team recently reviewed that literature. There's even some speculation that the things that aren't life-threatening but that are annoying, like acne, menstrual cramps, these are things that seem to be related to a westernized diet and seem not to occur so much on a plant-based diet. We need more research in some of these areas, but it's intriguing to see how many areas of life get better when you get the meats and the dairy products and greasy foods and sugar and junk out of your diet.
What's the average life expectancy of a vegan versus a traditional Western omnivore?
Depends a little bit on where you are, but it looks like vegans get about 10 years more life compared to other people. Now, but that's if you take a closer look at that, it's not entirely because of their diet. The diet probably is good for maybe 2 years of that. The other increased longevity is probably due to all the things that go along with being vegan. More exercise, the fact you're not smoking, and you're not abusing yourself in other ways.
Then let me break that down then. So for an average non-smoking, traditionally exercising omnivore, they might expect to live 2 years less than your average vegan.
What really matters, though, is how you live. And when a person is on a vegan diet, they are much less likely to be at the line in the pharmacy counter compared to the person who's following the non-vegan meaty diet.
Okay. But that's just generally factoring those two things. About 2 years for if you're, barring lifestyle, that you're right, that you might live healthier.
I'm citing the work of Gary Fraser in Seventh-day Adventists, and he would find about 2 years just through diet alone, but the diet quality dramatic, or the health quality dramatically better.
Okay. So the breaking of these other food addictions, we'll get to that. What are the what's the list of the foods that are most likely to be associated in your body to a drug, to like a morphine or a heroin? What is your body mistaking for a drug? We'll get to that next with Dr. Neil Barnard. You can link up to him through coasttocoastam.com. My blog is up too, which takes you to a couple of interesting links along this line, including that BBC story, which was very interesting because of the photos. In fact, I want to ask Dr. Barnard about those photos of those rhesus monkeys next on Coast to Coast AM. This is Ian Punnett.